90530, Texas Department of Public Safety versus Cox, Texas Newspaper. Justice Medina and Justice Willett are not sitting in that call.
Court, Mr. Morales will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
This court should hold that two exemptions to the Public Information Act, one statutory, one common law, extend to the information at issue in this case. First, the Texas Homeland Security Act expressly states that information, such as that found in the governor's protective details travel vouchers, are confidential.
There's some question about whether you preserve that argument. Would you address that after you point out your second basis?
Sure. The second basis is the common law physical safety exception, which protects those persons under a substantial threat of physical harm. Now, to the issue of waiver, which the respondents have raised, there are three reasons why this issue has not been waived. The first, the statute itself, the Homeland Security Act, states that specific information is confidential as a matter of law. So it's a mandatory statute. The statute itself says that information that's collected, assembled, maintained for or by a governmental entity for the purpose of preventing, detecting, or investigating an act of terrorism or related criminal activity and relates to staffing requirements or tactical plans of that law enforcement agency are confidential as a matter of law. So it's mandatory. So this court has repeatedly said that waiver cannot be invoked to nullify a mandatory statutory restriction. And we pointed the court to MOPAC Railroad versus Austin American Statesman from this court in 1977. That's the first basis for it not being waived. The second is that the PIA itself, the Information Act itself, criminalizes the disclosure of confidential information under other statutes. 552.352 expressly makes that a misdemeanor. And so DPS, in this particular case, has no discretion as to whether or not to disclose this information. And the third basis, of course, is that the department has always argued to the Attorney General, to the trial court, as well as to the Court of Appeals, that the protective detail travel vouchers are confidential under other law, under 522.022.
I was just, having been on a trial court and a Court of Appeals, I was just wondering how, I guess, the trial court is supposed to sit there and think about every other law that could possibly apply.
I will concede here before this court that it would have been preferable to have raised that in the trial court. But that was not done. It was an oversight. But the fact that it's mandatory means that it cannot be waived. And so it is squarely before this court. It is applicable to the vouchers at issue in this case. And it creates a statutory exemption to disclosure under the Act.
What are we to do with the fact-finding that these documents just don't fit under these categories?
Well, the fact-finding in the trial court did not
go to the Homeland Security Act issue.
And so
would we remand it, or?
It would be remanded for that purpose, or this court could, on the record here, say that it's squarely applicable and render. But certainly you can remand it to have that issue considered.
And with respect to the common law category, what about that? What do we need to do with the fact finding?
The fact finding that was done was both on the common law privacy issue that was raised in the trial court, and that was under the Attorney General's special circumstances test, as well as a 14th Amendment claim. The Court of Appeals reached the factual finding of the constitutional claim, the 14th Amendment claim, but they did not reach the fact finding on the common law claim. And so for that particular claim, under the standard that we have articulated and we're asking the court to recognize today for the physical safety exception, that would likewise be remanded back down to the Court of Appeals or the trial court to decide it under the proper standard.
The trial court had a hearing, took live testimony from witnesses, I understand, and before reaching its conclusions of fact, one of them, number 15, says public disclosure of the information at issue in the vouchers would not put any person in imminent threat of physical danger or create a substantial risk of serious bodily harm from a reasonably perceived likely threat. You're saying we should remand it and say, judge, think about it again?
No, not at all. The court did not have the benefit of this court's recognizing the common law exception of physical safety. That wasn't before. What they had in front of it
What new facts are going to be brought to the judge? The standards under the common law seem pretty similar. What new facts do you propose that the judge would consider in taking another look at this fact finding?
I don't believe there would be any new facts. I think what the court would have to decide is whether or not the disclosure of this information would constitute a substantial threat of physical safety being breached, in this case to the governor and to the first family and any that are protected. Now, but as far as the facts, no, I don't think that the trial court or this court needs any new facts. The unrebutted testimony of the trial court was expert testimony from the protective detail, from Lieutenant Armistead, that did, and he expressly stated, this constitutes a substantial threat to the governor, his family, and others that are being protected.
Was DPS violating criminal law when it released these vouchers in prior years, in 2004 and 5 and 7, or whenever?
The first release was 2002, 2004, and 2005, I believe. The Homeland Security Act came into effect in 2003, so 2002 is right. As far as 2004 and 2005, the department was relying on the Attorney General's rulings in those particular cases. The department at that time raised only the 108 exception, which is the law enforcement exception. The Attorney General, following this court's ruling in the City of Georgetown, said that exceptions within subsection C of the Act do not apply to 022 information or super public information.
If we read the Homeland Security Act as broadly as you suggest, isn't that just going to pretty much swallow up the Public Information Act as far as DPS is concerned?
I don't believe so.
Explain how it wouldn't.
Well, first of all, as the court is aware, the process that goes, it's always going to be subject to a mandamus proceeding. The department, in this particular case, or any other law enforcement agency, will make the determination in their professional judgment as law enforcement whether or not it meets that test. If they do believe it does, then they will withhold, ask the Attorney General for an opinion. The Attorney General will then decide whether or not it does. There's that measure, that check, if you will, there. Mm-hmm. And as the court is aware, it was almost a year ago that the case of the date of birth records with CPA, with the Comptroller's Office, was argued here before this court. And the Attorney General did not agree with the Comptroller's Office on that particular case. So it very well could be that the Attorney General does not agree with the department. But then beyond that, certainly there's a mandamus proceeding that would decide whether or not that particular statute exemption is applicable.
How does the release of prior vouchers pose a future threat to a public official like the governor?
As the testimony of the trial court revealed, when you take these vouchers and the information that's contained in them, you can discern how many protective detail are with the governor and his family at any particular time. If they go to a certain location, they may take 5. If they go to another location, they may take 2.
How do you distinguish that argument from the Attorney General's opinion in 2010 with respect to a district attorney who sought to prevent calendar entries and communications because it would interfere with law enforcement? There, the Attorney General said, you know, looking at past information doesn't demonstrate how a release of current information would interfere with law enforcement. And I see a pretty close parallel between the two cases.
I'll be candid, I'm not familiar with that particular ruling, but I can say that.
I'll give you the number for the record, and you can respond later. It's Texas Attorney General Opinion OR 2010-10168.
But I can speak to this specific case, and if that had to do with the district attorney, certainly this has to do with the Department of Public Safety, the protective detail, which is a very unique situation where this detail's entire job, their entire reason for being is to protect the governor 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Well, what is the purpose of maintaining the vouchers? We know the purpose of the detail, they're to protect the governor. The purpose of maintaining the vouchers?
Of maintaining them as confidential?
No, just maintaining them. Because the act you're talking about there, it says the right. Purpose of for the purpose these documents are if it's collected, assembled, or maintained for the purpose of preventing, detecting. Seems to me like maybe the purpose of maintaining those vouchers is simply a record-keeping function as opposed to something that might be for the purpose of preventing something in the future. I'm having a trouble with the purpose language.
I think there is a very narrow, limited purpose, just like there is for any voucher for any of any state employee to get reimbursed for expenses. That's a very narrow, but the broader.
That's why it's generated.
Generally. I mean,
that's why you make it start with. So how does that fit in for the purpose of being to defeat these acts of terrorism or something?
Because these vouchers would not exist. These particular vouchers at issue and all the ones for the protective detail would not exist but for the protective detail detecting and trying to thwart terrorism or other related criminal
acts. And that's the purpose for which those vouchers are created?
That's why they were created, yes. They were created to as part of the entire tactical situation where the protective detail needs to travel with the governor wherever he goes. And then by the very fact that they are traveling, they need to submit these vouchers. It's part and parcel of the entire operation. But yes, it does serve a very narrow function. But for example.
It seems like, you know, the legislature passed this statute 52-151 that's not argued as being effective here. But in that it talks about information in the custody of a governmental body that relates to it. It seems like they very directly addressed the problem we're talking about here with language fairly significantly different from what's in 418-176.
Well, sure. And if I could speak to the new statute, 151, which the legislature passed the last time around, that statute does articulate very well what the Attorney General for the last 30 years, from John Hill all the way to Greg Abbott, have been applying as far as special circumstances to protect the physical safety of persons that would be affected by the disclosure of particular public information. That statute, of course, as was briefed ad nauseum, is not applicable to these particular vouchers because the vouchers are contained and are subject to 022.
There are a number of categories that are not explicitly statutory. That you would have us at least review. Things like privacy, physical safety. Would you include something like identity theft in that? I mean, there's another case pending here, as you mentioned, where an argument is made that the release of information, although it's not required to be exempted statutorily, but the release of information would have the effect of compromising the identities of hundreds of thousands of people.
I believe the controller in that case argued that that fits within the Industrial Foundation of the South framework mm-hmm. under privacy. And so, yes, we would agree that the court can and has looked in the past at common law to protect those interests that have already existed in common law. So in that particular case, in Industrial Foundation, of course, it was privacy, the same with the date of birth records. In this case, physical safety under the longstanding common law of battery would not seemingly be as applicable as privacy. Privacy would seem to be a closer fit.
I just want to be clear about what we talked about earlier. You don't think that there's a necessity for further evidentiary hearing. You just think that the evidence that there has already been offered and admitted needs to be reviewed under whatever standard
yes, Your Honor.
We come up with. So we could do that as well as the lower courts.
Absolutely.
Question about Industrial Foundation. As you know, that was our opinion in 1976, which applied the Billings decision, our opinion from 1973 about a privacy right. The Public Information Act in Texas was passed in 1973 and seemed to, at least in part, adopt Billings when it said that protections recognized by the judiciary can also accept public information from disclosure. The Industrial Foundation opinion, there was no majority opinion, it was very splintered, three plurality, two separate concurrences, and a four justice dissent, but all nine agreed on this proposition that the court is not free to balance the public's interest in disclosure against the harm resulting to an individual by reason of disclosure. This policy determination was made by the legislature when it enacted the statute. We declined to adopt, I'm quoting now, an interpretation which would allow the court in its discretion to deny disclosure even though there is no specific exception provided. Are you saying that we should, although you cite Industrial Foundation to support much of your argument that the court can recognize common law exceptions that are not in the statute, Industrial Foundation itself, and all nine agreed on this proposition, says that we should not create common law exceptions that are not in the statute. How do you reconcile that seeming contradiction in your argument?
I would say that the court wouldn't be creating a common law exception. It would be recognizing something that has always existed. I think that certainly back before there was a Public Information Act in 1973.
But this court has never recognized the exception you're arguing for today.
Yes, the court
would. The Attorney General has, yes. For, as you pointed out, for a long time.
Yes. No, the court has not, and that is what we are asking the court to do today.
To recognize a new exception.
Yes, to the Public Information Act, but it's an exception that we would argue has always been there in the common law. When there was just a common law right to inspect public records, there's always been that. Nixon versus Warner Communications back in 1976 held that there's always been common law that says the public has a right to inspect the goings-on of government, including courts. But that's tempered, and it always has been tempered, by the ability of the custodian to exercise judgment as the custodian to prevent harm. Now, that's always been the subject of mandamus, and then the PIA came along. And so that common law has always been there, and we're just asking the court to recognize that common law right that's always been there.
And I realize your time has expired. You know, the federal opinions on Freedom of Information Act apply a different statute with some different language than the Texas Public Information Act. And I haven't looked at Nixon recently. But let me ask a final question, which is, how far does your argument take us? What's the principled line drawing that stops this court from continuing to recognize common law exceptions? We recognized one. I would phrase it as the legislature recognized one in Billings. Where do you draw the line saying the court can stop recognizing new, unexpressed exceptions to disclosure that are not in the PIA? If we recognize one, where does it stop?
I think that's a fair question, and I would answer it this way. Last session, the legislature did speak to the physical safety exception in 151. They expressly said that the release of the information would subject the person to a substantial threat of physical harm. So they have addressed that, and that takes us a little bit of the way for some very limited state employees.
Although the legislature could have made that statute retroactive and did not, so it doesn't apply to this case, does it?
They could have, but even if they had and placed it in the same place, it wouldn't apply to these 022 vouchers. And so it really was the placement of it more than whether it, that's that was And whether that was intentional or not, I can't speculate as to what, why the legislature put this in any particular place. But what I can express to the court is that common law right has always been there. The legislature is free to come back and expand that if they want. But just like in City of Georgetown, even though there were rules and PIA exceptions concerning attorney-client and work product privileges, this court went ahead and said and recognized that those derived from common law before. And so the court can do so again in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Morales. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Christian will present the argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. I'm William Christian. I'm here on behalf of the respondents, Cox Texas Newspapers and Hearst Newspapers, LLC. The information detailing the way in which government spends tax dollars is fundamentally public information. And the travel vouchers at issue are an important tool of the news media, my clients, in reporting on and keeping the public apprised on the conduct of public officials.
If it were proven that information requested would jeopardize safety of public employees, you think there's still no exception?
There currently is no exception. If it were proven, which I think is the big caveat
right,
here,
were,
then that would be a situation where this court perhaps should determine whether the common law, whether it's privacy or some other right or tort, should be expanded or covers that particular situation.
Well, I guess I understood your brief to say it shouldn't be expanded no matter what.
It shouldn't be expanded in this case because the facts don't support it, because the legislature has already acted in this in reaction to the Court of Appeals decision and has not exercised its discretion to make these vouchers confidential.
So, but you're acknowledging that personal safety is at least as important an interest as privacy, and if it were really at stake, there should be an other law exception for it.
Or absolutely, personal safety is a very important exception, and it's not our intention to put any public official or public employee in danger. And if there were truly a situation, factual situation, presented to this court where releasing a piece of paper was going to put the governor or someone else in an imminent threat of physical harm, then I think that's an appropriate situation for this court to perhaps examine what the common law basis for withholding that information would be.
Is that a middle ground that would be acceptable to you? And could you expand on that as far as other situations where it would be acceptable?
Well, I think my position is it's not necessary to get into that in this case because of the facts and the fact findings in this case. And the problem is, once you start down that road, where do you stop? Where do you draw the line? How do you set the standard in a way that is going to capture this hypothetical situation for the future?
Well, also, I mean, none of us judges from the trial court to the Court of Appeals that I'm aware of to this court are law enforcement officers. I mean, is there, with the expertise that they have in determining when and to what extent there is a threat to a public official from the release of information, shouldn't there be some kind of deference that the court pays to their expert judgments on these matters or not?
I don't have a problem with deference to experts, Your Honor, but I do have a problem with just going with the say-so of what a governmental agency says about whether something is a threat or not a threat. I think whatever, you know, if you choose to write on this, set some sort of standard that the courts have to play a role in testing the assertions of the governmental body, and after a full trial, a full and fair trial, where they get to put on their witnesses, they get to choose the representative sample of the documents that they submit to the judge in camera, and the judge makes that call that they haven't met that burden, then they have to release those records. It can't be simply because the government body says it's a problem or a threat, therefore that
there was a famous exchange in the U.S. Supreme Court, and seems to me it was in the Pentagon Papers case, where questions similar to what Justice Heck posed to you earlier was presented to counsel. And it is, you know, counsel, if we were to release this information or hold it disclosed and you knew that people were then going to be exposed to physical danger, would you still be making the argument? And I think the answer was no in that in that case, that those, that there are going to be exceptions. So what we're trying to do here is, if that is your answer, figure out what those exceptions would be. And to a certain extent, you have to predict what would happen were some information released. And I mean, there is something of a professional guess or judgment. So when do we find that line is crossed and when not? What's the principle?
Well, I think it is, perhaps I would suggest, a question that is best left for another day in a case that presents a factual situation that does rise to the level of that physical safety threat. Again, the factual findings here, based on the evidence that the trial judge found, don't give the court that basis. And if you are...
But the problem with that is, at least to me, the Court of Appeals explanation, which is, well, maybe some threat in the past, but no threat going forward. Well, I mean, when would there ever be a threat going forward? The follow-up question is, how do we know when we see evidence that it amounts to an imminent physical threat?
Yeah, I it's a difficult line to draw, to be sure, if that's the road that you're going to go down in crafting some sort of...
Well, you already said you already said we should, I thought.
Well, I'm saying that I don't say that you shouldn't in the proper case, but that this case doesn't present the facts upon which you should craft that rule.
All right, but in a case in which there... I mean, how would we know when that case got here if we didn't know what we were looking for?
Well, I think it would be a case where the government body hasn't released the very documents in the past over the years, and there has been no problem at all.
The vouchers say very particularly that when the governor travels out of state, there are two people that follow, you know, in a car or stay at the hotel with the governor. There is one person outside. And this is repeated over and over again, so that
He's going to stay in room 343
or just the or number of personnel, like the number of security officers that are in place. I mean, that would be valuable information to someone who might want to do harm.
Well, what I would suggest is resisting a standard that is sitting there and thinking up some way in which some unidentified person could possibly cause harm based on the information that is there. I think that's a standard where it becomes a standardless standard, and it does threaten to swallow the act, because any piece of information, if you sit down and think there long enough, you can probably come up with some way that some person could make use of that information if they were bent on causing harm to another person. But I think if it is something that is, you know, clearly identifiable to the person in question, and the governmental body can explain perhaps who they fear might use this information and exactly how they might use this information, other than I don't really know how they might use it, but it might prove useful, then that might be a situation that rises to that level where the court would want to address that.
So they would have to come in and explain the threat level that's existing in order to protect the documents each time? I can look back and say, well, in 2002 or even 2004 and 5, maybe there weren't threats that exist now. And so are you saying that, well, because you've disclosed those in the past, I mean, sort of undercuts your decision now, is the agency still then required to come in and say, well, things are different now, and here's why?
If things are different now and they can explain why, then maybe they didn't do it in this case.
But maybe they shouldn't have to do that either. Explaining what the specific threat is now that would make it different than the year before.
Well, I think they would have to if they're going to explain how releasing these vouchers are going to cause some imminent or substantial threat to public safety.
But doesn't that go to what Justice Heck was talking about, or Chief Justice Jefferson, in the sense that you've got a law enforcement question here that none of us are equipped to decide?
I don't think it is necessarily, I think the courts are perfectly equipped to decide what, you know, whether the evidence meets a certain legal standard. And for instance, the new statute, a substantial threat to the public, to the safety of a public official or a public employee. Courts are going to have to, the Attorney General and courts are going to have to apply that standard in certain factual situations, and it's going to be based on evidence. And yes, expert testimony, if the expert qualifies and explains, you know, consistent with the rules of evidence, how his or her opinion is based up, is supported by the facts that they're relying on, that can be something the court can defer to. But there has always got to be a role for the court to test the government's assertion that any particular document is going to pose this threat of public safety. To do otherwise would undermine the Act's purpose and interest in ensuring government accountability and access to governmental information, as expressly stated in the public policy of the Act.
If this same question were presented in federal court and involved the executive branch of the United States, do you have an opinion on what the courts have held, how the case would turn out under the federal Act?
Well, the federal Act, of course, is different. I've searched for some analogous case involving, say, the Secret Service travel vouchers of the president, and I haven't found any such case. The FOIA doesn't contain this 552.022 statute that we're dealing with here that explicitly makes vouchers releasable under the Public Information Act unless expressly confidential under the law, under other law. The only recent analogous case that I can point you to, Chief Justice, is the photos detailing detainee abuse in Iraq. The Court of Appeals held that those photos had to be released over the government's assertions that doing so would cause harm to our military in the field, that there was no exception that justified withholding those, and that the ACLU, I believe, was entitled to those photographs.
But the argument there was a consequential harm, right? That by making the photos public, you would infuriate the opposition and more people would be shot.
I think it was along those lines.
But it wasn't that they're going to find out the name of one of the guards and track him home and do him in on the way.
That's true. And what happened there was the Congress intervened in between the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court and passed a specific law that made those specific documents confidential. Of course, it was a big debate in the presidential election, and President Obama, I believe, switched his opinion on that, and that's how that happened. Here, again, we have a statute passed by the legislature in reaction to our Court of Appeals opinion.
Do you think it correctly states the common law exception, 151?
I think it certainly encompasses what the Attorney General's opinion was, and we don't have a problem with that particular standard in this case, again, because the trial court applied that standard and found that these vouchers are wanting.
So if there were going to be a common law, other law exception, 151 is not any different from what it would be?
Probably so. I think something along the lines of the imminent threat that the Attorney General came up with, or the statutory provision that the legislature passed.
And even if that statute did apply, you still prevail.
Right, and it doesn't apply. And I think that is another reason why this court should be hesitant to jump in and announce a new common law rule, because the legislature has, for the vast majority of information that government bodies hold, passed a standard that the DPS is asking you to pass. What we're dealing with here are, well, probably now there are no Public Information Act requests that predate the enactment of this law, so the retroactivity issue is gone. We're dealing with a specific statute that lists 18 categories of public information, most of which are dealing with the way in which the government spends public funds, vouchers, accounts, contracts, things like that. And for whatever reason, the legislature chose not to extend the protection that it passed for public safety to information in that category. So the question is why, in this case, where the facts don't present it, does this court need to go and make a new common law rule or a new common law standard when the legislature didn't do so and the facts don't support it? I also want to address Industrial Foundation, because I think that is there's really no greater disagreement in the analysis in the briefs than what that case means. And I think Justice Wainwright's recitation of the quote was exactly our position, that the court went 30 years ago said that the judiciary should not go creating common law exceptions to disclosure, that there is no basis for the judiciary to withhold information when there's no specific exception in the Act or some firmly grounded tort, such as the invasion of privacy tort that was addressed there. I don't think you can go and create a common law exception in this case without overruling the statutory interpretation that this court took in Industrial Foundation. Again, you're certainly within your power to do that, But all the reasons for stare decisis in cases interpreting statutes are here. The legislature has never, in the years since Industrial Foundation, passed any kind of statute that gives the judiciary the discretion to adopt common law exceptions or the ability to balance in a particular case whether the interest in security or some other good reason might outweigh the interest in disclosure.
But you, again, let me be sure I understand. If 151 had not been passed and there were no such thing as section 418.176, you still think there should be a common law exception if personal safety is truly at stake, imperiled? Unquestionably imperiled.
Unquestionably imperiled. I certainly think that is something that the court or any court would want it to prevent from happening, because I certainly, it's not our client's position that we want to see anybody hurt. And if
physically.
Yeah. If there were, I think that hypothetical factual situation is not present in this case. And unless and until it does, I don't think the court needs to go messing with the Industrial Foundation case, addressing why it needs to get involved when the legislature made a certain decision to pass a statute that didn't cover these records and the facts of this case.
You acknowledge that if you're entitled to it or if your client is entitled to it, anyone can get that information, correct? I mean, your motives may be completely and are. Let's state that completely pure. Your government, the fourth branch, and you're looking at government accountability and that sort of thing. But you concede that if you're entitled to them, then organizations or people who have less pristine motives would also be entitled to that information.
Under the Act, I think that is true, that there's no basis for discriminating against a requester. But I think that's another important consideration to take into account when setting what I think, if you're going to set some kind of common law standard, that it is a clear standard and one that doesn't just simply defer to the governmental body. Because if you're treating every public information request by imagining the worst possible things that could happen, or treating every requester like a criminal, then that is going to, again, undermine the public policies of openness that are expressed in the Public Information Act, that everyone is entitled to the information about government unless expressly made confidential under other law. That those kind of values that are expressed in the Act would be completely undermined by some kind of approach that would simply assume the worst about any requester, even if that is, as you say, is not even present in this particular case. I want to briefly touch on the waiver provision on their second argument, the statutory argument that they brought up first in their argument. They mentioned this MOPAC versus American Statesman case. That's not even an error preservation case. I believe it's a contributory negligence case, which said that when a railroad bridge by statute has to be built at a certain height, some engineer can't waive that requirement by telling someone it's okay to build a little lower. It had nothing to do with failing to raise an argument in the trial court and then raising it only at the Texas Supreme Court level. The only other case that they cite is a juvenile delinquency case, where this court recognized a narrow exception because of the quasi-criminal nature of those proceedings for fundamental error that wasn't preserved in the cases below. But since then, it has restricted that doctrine to those juvenile delinquency proceedings. In a parental termination case, it said fundamental error doesn't apply. The only situation where this court has entertained an argument that was not raised in the trial court or the Court of Appeals is something affecting the court's subject matter jurisdiction. And of course, this particular argument doesn't. The fact that the criminal argument is also not an excuse for failing to preserve error. There's no criminal law exception to error preservation. No one would be prosecuted for turning over records in compliance with a judgment of the trial court or this court. That is not a basis for excusing waiver. And the other law bases that they argued were very specific, and the judge is not obligated to search through all the statutes to find whatever some other law that they chose or failed to raise at the trial court below. Well, as I said at the beginning, the travel vouchers like these are important tools for the public to hold the public services accountable for the way in which government spends its tax dollars. The legislature recognized this by placing vouchers within the 022 statute. DPS had a full and fair trial to establish the reasons that they believe that this shouldn't be withheld. The district court applied the legal standards it asked that that DPS asked the district court to apply, and DPS failed to meet its burden. As a matter of fact, releasing these vouchers poses no substantial threat of physical harm. Under these circumstances, we think you should leave for another day any changes to the common law or any changes to the interpretation of the Public Information Act, and should instead hold my client's statutory right of access to this information and affirm the judgment below.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Counsel for respondent said that why should this court hold these documents to be not subject to the PIA when the Attorney General, when the department itself has released them in the past? All of the releases, well, let's put it this way, the department has always objected to the release of the vouchers for the Veterans Protective Detail. They have never voluntarily just give them over. They have it always been subject to the Attorney General's ruling on whatever exception they presented. In the cases at issue that respondent is talking about, the department raised the 108 exception that the Attorney General said did not apply to 022 information. There was one or two other times that this happened again, but those were, the department relied on prior determinations on the exact same vouchers that the Attorney General had said you need to turn over. So the department has always protected these. There's never been a time that the department has not. The only time they've been turned over, it's been pursuant to the Attorney General's rulings.
Are you, counsel, seeking to hold that these vouchers should be accepted from disclosure or should be deemed confidential?
I think they're one and the same. I think they're confidential under the common law, and then therefore under 101, they are accepted from disclosure.
Well, under the PIA, there's several categories of information. If they're accepted from disclosure, the public entity can still voluntarily turn them over if they want to. If they're confidential under the PIA, there's no discretion to turn them over. And in fact, turning them over is a criminal offense. So are you asking for an exception or to that they be deemed confidential?
And I'll answer it this way, and I will do my best to answer it. I think the City of Georgetown case muddled the waters a little bit in that there are mandatory exceptions that the Attorney General rules on, and there are discretionary exceptions. And City of Georgetown doesn't distinguish between those. But the Attorney General does in its rulings going back. Now, so what we're asking for this court is to say, yes, under common law, these are confidential. And so, as well as under the Homeland Security Act. And so, therefore, the criminal issues arise as far as not having discretion to turn them over. And so are they waivable? We would argue that they're not. And so we are asking that they're confidential as a matter of law. And then so they are public information, but they're confidential as a matter of law. Therefore, they should not be produced.
Are you saying more generally that if DPS decides that these should be exempted, that they should, that decision should control, basically?
No, I think that's the starting point. Okay. I think that the law enforcement agency makes that professional judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Once they do that, they present it to the Attorney General and saying, we want to withhold these. And the Attorney General will decide whether or not they have met their burden to establishing whether or not there is a substantial threat of physical harm. If they have not, then it needs to be turned over. If they do, then it gets to go on. And if the requester wants to take it up on mandamus, they very well can do that. I have limited time, but I wanted to let the court know the department does not take lightly bringing these issues up to this court and asking this court to recognize a common law exception to the Public Information Act. In this case, as the record reflects, the department did turn over all of the numbers as far as how much money was spent for all of these things. They turned them over in the aggregate, and they turned them over in categories of what was spent on lodging, what was spent on meals, what was spent on all this. It's not that the department does not want the public to have access to what their tax dollars are spent on. They absolutely have the right to that. And so that was turned over, but because of the need to protect the tactical information, the operations of the protective detail, what kind of vehicles they use, whether they're armored, whether they're not armored, how many folks are you taking, how far in advance does the protective detail go out when they're going to a particular location.
The Attorney General's opinion seems fairly deferential to those. Should the courts be the same? You say you represent, and based on that, it's confidential.
I do think that a certain amount of deference to law enforcement in these particular areas is required. Again, although I represent the department, I am not a law enforcement officer, and I don't know, and I rely on their professional judgment to decide whether that is right. Now, I will say that the Attorney General is entitled to deference by this court, because it's the legislature themselves that decided that the Attorney General will interpret the act, as well as ensure its uniform applicability. So the legislature has decided that the Attorney General will have that role, and so there's a certain deference that needs to be applied there as well. 34 years ago, this court decided that there was recognized a common law exception to the PIA that protects intimate, private facts. And the court was well within its discretion to do that. What we're talking about here is the physical safety, not only of the first family and foreign dignitaries that the protective detail protects, but also that whole category of people that have come under the physical safety exception that the Attorney General has been ruling on for the past 30 years.
Or even if this court travels, our security detail.
Or mine. Yes, that's exactly right. If the court can recognize that there's a common law interest that needs to protect someone's private, intimate facts, then certainly to protect the physical safety of people that would be affected by a substantial threat of physical harm by the release of information should be protected as well.
Thank you, Mr. Morales. That concludes this argument. The cause is submitted. All arguments for this morning have concluded. The marshal will now adjourn the court.